and welcome back to Vocation Station on Divine Mercy Radio. This is Father Alfredo Hernandez, the Rector President of St. Vincent de Paul Regional Seminary, and it is good to be with you today. We have with us for our session this month Dr. Rodney Hauser, who is a professor of theology and philosophy here at St. Vincent de Paul Regional Seminary, and almost through his first year with us on faculty. And we thought it would be interesting to have a chance to talk to one of the lay professors here at the seminary about the great work we do here. So, Dr. Hauser, it is wonderful to have you with us.
It's an honor to be here. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So, Dr. Hauser, you are not new to South Florida, even though you've just come to us. So give us a little bit of your backstory. I think this is going to be interesting. This is not exactly the journal home on EWTN, but there's a little bit of that in your story, certainly. So why don't you tell us a little bit your backstory?
Yeah, Florida is, I grew up in Pennsylvania as a kid, but I went to college in Lakeland, Florida at an Assemblies of God college of all things. And that's where I met my wife, who is a Floridian, a native Floridian. She grew up in West Palm Beach, but she also went to Southeastern. So my experience of being in Florida and spending time with her family and stuff goes way back to the 1983 is when I started college, but I met my wife in 85 and started coming to West Palm Beach in around 86 and 87. So it's interesting. It's kind of like being back home in a way.
And so you said Assemblies of God. That's not exactly Catholic. So can you tell us a little bit your story growing in the faith, growing professionally, and how that crossing of the Tiber took place for you?
Yeah, that's a kind of a long story. I'll try to keep it as short as I can. I always talk about kind of three conversions. One of the things about growing up in a church like the Assemblies of God, which is very what we call low church Protestant, almost no religious baggage whatsoever, just straight me and Jesus kind of approach. There are disadvantages to that, of course, which I grew to understand better. But one of the advantages is that from the time you're a little kid, you're immersed in hearing the gospel on a regular basis. And my parents were already going to that church when I was born, so I literally like teethed on the church pews. And we went to church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. So I heard 30 to 45 minute sermons three times a week. And I remember very early on, maybe even 6 or 7, being very struck by the sermons and finding myself listening to them even when I was trying to be mischievous with my friends in the back row. I would get caught up in the thing. And I really had a kind of profound religious conversion probably at the age of 8 or 9, where I really became convicted that I was a sinner and that I needed Christ and, all of that stuff. So that was my sort of first conversion. But in time, intellectually, et cetera, I didn't find as much satisfaction in that as I wished I had. And when I began studying as an undergrad and studying church history especially, I began to realize that the church didn't come into existence with Martin Luther.
And so, shocking.
Yeah. So that was a big revelation for me.
The journey into the Catholic Church happened shortly thereafter.
And so it was actually a long journey for me. So
I didn't think so. I think I know some of the story, but
yeah. So what happened was when I graduated from Southeastern, I went back to my hometown to work as an associate pastor in my Assemblies of God church in Bedford, Pennsylvania. And I did that for a little over a year, knowing all the time that I wasn't going to do that permanently. I had kind of discovered that my gifts were more in theology than in pastoral ministry, although I don't think I was a terrible associate pastor. I certainly wasn't the best. So after a year and a half of doing that, my wife and I moved to Bowling Green, Kentucky, where I went to study philosophy at Western Kentucky University. And again, in studying philosophy, I began to realize the need for a more intellectually robust version of faith. And we began attending a Presbyterian church in Bowling Green. It's actually in Franklin, Kentucky, but very close to Bowling Green. And the richness of the theology of the Reformed tradition was very, very important to me. And in fact, I took my first course on Thomas Aquinas from a Reformed philosopher named Arvin Voss, who wrote his dissertation on Aquinas, of all things. And so, strangely, Presbyterianism was my first exposure also to Catholicism, in a sense.
Assemblies of God, the Presbyterian.
Yes.
Okay, that's moving in a direction.
Yes, yes. And then it gets worse. when I finished my graduate degree at Western Kentucky, then I went to Marquette, which is, of course, the Jesuit university in Milwaukee. And after about a year of studying the fathers and the medievals more and Catholic theology more, I desired to have a more liturgical experience, a more liturgical religious experience. So we now converted to Episcopalianism.
Okay, that's another step.
Yes. And in the Episcopalianism of Milwaukee, there's a very famous seminary, Neshota House, very close to Milwaukee. It's very, very high church Episcopalianism. So lots of smells and bells and chanting the gospel and all of that stuff. And that we both really, really appreciated that beautiful liturgical tradition. And I had no intention at the time of converting to Catholicism, but the more I grew in my faith and the more I studied and things like that, the more I realized it was inevitable eventually.
And so eventually you entered the Catholic Church and you went to teach theology at DeSales University, right?
That's correct.
In Allentown?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So tell us a little about that and the beauty of teaching theology before you... This is obviously many years before you came to seminary teaching.
Yeah.
The beauty of being able to share theology with the people of God.
Yes. So it's
young people.
Yeah. No. It's something I just love. I love it to this day. I loved it from the first day I did it, and so I feel very, very lucky because I think a lot of people end up in a career that doesn't match their vocation, if I could put it that way, and their job is kind of a thing that gets in the way of their, you know, other things they'd like to be doing. I have been so lucky to feel like that's never been the case for me. Like, what I do for a living is what I love to do, and so I feel very blessed. So I started at DeSales University. It was called Allentown College of St. Francis DeSales at the time, in 1999, and I taught there until 2025. So I taught there for 26 years. And it's a very interesting experience teaching at your typical small Catholic liberal arts school. The majority of the students are nominally Catholic, but the majority of the students are also at the same time not practicing Catholic. Or if they're practicing Catholic, they're practicing it begrudgingly because maybe they feel like they're going to go to hell if they don't. But there's not an enormous lot of enthusiasm from students about the faith in a typical undergraduate theology course. So it's a little bit more like you spend half of the semester just trying to convince them why they should study theology and why they should be enthusiastic about their faith. And that's kind of fun because it's like a mission field a little bit.
Oh, yeah, that definitely is. And that's certainly what we're preparing for men here, is to be in that mission field.
Yeah.
And everything we do here in terms of our work of preparing seminarians, preparing permanent deacon candidates, and lay people who take some of our classes as well, who are in our master's program, but certainly especially in the formation of priests, helping them to love theology, but really to know it, to understand it, to be able to bring it, bring the truths of the faith, bring the truth of Jesus Christ to all that they're going to serve. And so don't need to get into all the history in terms of this has been in terms of our conversation. It's the what is the Lord calling you to? And so how have you felt that the Lord calling you to this work of seminary and what's been joyful about that for this as you're now teaching theology? Maybe we can focus especially on that in our conversation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have gifts given to us to do things, but I think those things that we're called to do often change over time. So again, for 26 years, I was more like being something like in a mission field where you're just trying to convince people that this is worth thinking about and talking about. But I now see that having been at the seminary even for just a year, that experience that I had in the trenches, so to speak, for all that time actually has really helped me at the seminary. Because I want my seminarians now to understand that many of the people in the pews are there, but they may be there out of habit or routine, and they may not really have thought through why they believe the things that they are, you know, being taught in the church and stuff like that. So many, many times as an undergraduate teacher, I would teach students something, And somebody would come up to me after class and say, why didn't anybody ever tell me that? And I was like, I don't know. And so I want to make sure, I feel like part of my job at the seminary is to make sure that the young men who go out to be priests here, make sure they tell the people the things that they, that you know, the good news, if you will. And so that's been a good experience of bridging my experience at undergrad to my experience at teaching at the seminary.
Great. So yeah. I want to tell our audience a little bit about the classes that you are teaching and just what class have you taught this year?
Yeah, so this year so far I have taught fundamental theology, which is my favorite, that's my wheelhouse, if you will. That's kind of what my dissertation was on. And fundamental theology is just kind of asking about what is theology? How do you do theology? What kind of a discipline is it? And what are the methods that you use to do it and all those things? And so there's a lot of philosophy in it and all of that stuff. So that is a treat for me to get to do it, because at the undergraduate level, you can't really broach those more complicated questions. So that was my very first class, my very first day. I felt like I had died and gone to heaven, because I had 13 young men who were super enthusiastic about the material. I was like, what is happening? It was such an interesting experience. So what's nice about, so I taught fundamental theology. I also have taught ecclesiology and ecumenism, which is also very interesting to me, having been a Protestant. So dialogue with Protestantism has been something I've been doing, you know, in my own mind for a long, long time. And then also I'm teaching Trinity and Christology to the deacons, to the MAT students this term, and that's been delightful also. So it's fun for me, because at the seminary I'm actually able to teach theology. I don't have to convince them that we should be studying theology. They're already convinced.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. I guess I have in my apartment a book that I use. I taught fundamental theology many, many years ago,
yeah.
And I used the Dictionary of Fundamental Theology, which is a wonderful collection of articles,
yeah.
And also a book that had the subtitle was by somebody who taught me in Rome, Salvador Pianino is the theologian's name, and the subtitle was Always be ready to give a reason for the hope that is in you,
yeah.
From 1 Peter 3:15. And that's really what we're called to do. Always, sometimes we think about faith as being this, like we're all about faith, and we forget that reason is essential. And yeah. For Catholics, we cannot act without reason. That's we're absolutely convinced that faith and reason always have to go hand in hand,
yeah.
And always be able to give a reason for our hope. That's essential to everything that we do.
Yeah.
And sometimes people are open to that, and sometimes they aren't. But we need to try, yeah. and that's certainly that great work that's so important for you to do in terms of helping our seminarians have that.
Yeah.
So those are very important classes you're teaching, as you said, teaching both the seminarians and teaching the permanent deacon candidates and lay
yeah.
people who are taking classes.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit. I think it might be good for people to hear a little bit about theology, specifically fundamental theology. That maybe that question for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Always being ready to give a reason for hope. Where is the reason for your hope, and how does that then help you in your work of theology?
Yeah, that's good, and that kind of ties into some of the things that I was talking about earlier. My earlier teaching experience, at least 50% of what I was doing was apologetics, what we call apologetics, which is giving a reason for your hope. And I think a lot of times we have to be careful. And I was talking to the seminarians about this, that. We can get away as Catholics, we think, or at least we think we can, just saying, well, because the church says so. You know, why do we believe this, or why do we? Well, because we've always believed it, or the church says so, or whatever. And obviously, from a Catholic perspective, that is not sufficient. Like we do believe these things on divine authority, and that's absolutely crucial. But we're also expected to think about them. And so, having done that for so many years with the undergrads, being challenged about everything. you know, that nothing was taken for granted. They're like, well, why should I believe the Bible just because it's, you know, whatever. It was a good experience for me having that kind of opposition or that kind of skepticism. And I want the priests here to understand that they're going to have it too, believe it or not. There are people in the pew who are skeptical about some of the church's teachings.
There are?
Rodney,
you're shocking me.
Yeah. And so we would actually have these exercises in class where we would say, okay, how would you defend that teaching? If somebody asked you this, what would you say? And at the beginning, they were struggling a lot of times to answer those questions, but they got better at it as we went. And that was very gratifying to me. Because I think it's one of the most important things a priest can do is be able to give reasons to his people, because they're also going to be challenged in the workplace and in the world. The Catholic faith is not exactly taken for granted in 21st century America.
And to be able to give those explanations, but also St. Peter doesn't just stop there. He says, but do it with reverence.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Get another Bible, but do it with reverence and with love. It's like there's a I'm missing the exact word, but it's right. Like how do we do it is essential. It can't just be hitting people over the head with it.
Absolutely, and so the course that I taught that I just finished this term on ecclesiology and ecumenism, one of the parts of that course is learning how to dialogue with somebody who doesn't belong to your tradition. And it's very, very important to learn to listen, to understand where they're coming from, what their presuppositions are, knowing what your presuppositions are, and then being able to converse without losing your identity. So we spent a lot of the semester, the term, I should say, this past term, studying how to engage somebody in a respectful, loving manner without denying who you are. It's okay to dialogue with someone with an identity and accepting their identity, but still having a genuine dialogue.
You know, that might be a helpful thing maybe to share with our audience, because I'm sure that many of our listeners, I assume most of them have non-Catholic Christian friends.
Yes.
And particular ecumenism, obviously, we know is not how we get along with everybody, but how we relate specifically to non-Catholic Christians.
Yeah.
Maybe just a word about how do you do that? How do you have that conversation that is rooted in what unites us, is honest in terms of, I'm not pretending that we're just going to agree to get along, but that we really have a very real dialogue in the faith, acknowledging our differences. Maybe just a few words on that.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think the one thing that you just become aware of when I was converting to Catholicism, for instance, both my family and my in-laws were not exactly thrilled. And so having to explain to them what Catholics believe about X, Y, and Z because of the caricatures of the Catholic faith that are so common in the mind of many, many Protestants. But I was telling my seminarians this term, we also can caricaturize other people's beliefs. Some of my seminarians, for instance, were shocked to find out that Martin Luther believed in the real presence in the Eucharist, for instance. I told a famous saying that he said, he called the Anabaptists fanatics, so I'll just set it up with that. He said, I would rather drink sheer blood with the Pope than mere wine with the fanatics. and my seminarians were very stirred. He believed in the real presence? And even, you know, some of the things about his understanding of faith and works is more nuanced than we often get it presented when we Catholics learn about Luther from other Catholics. So I was lucky enough to learn my Martin Luther from a Lutheran, and that doesn't mean I agree with Martin Luther on everything, but I learned to realize that his positions were complicated and nuanced. And so a lot of, I think, the important thing that happens in the early stages of dialogue is just correcting misconceptions, and that's a really important stage of the game.
Yeah, and most Catholics, but I would wager most Lutherans and Methodists aren't aware that in the late 90s, there was an agreement between the Catholic Church and the World Lutheran, the umbrella group for Lutherans across the world, and then a little bit later, the Methodists joined this agreement,
yep,
saying that that question of faith and works should no longer divide us.
Yeah.
So that's a fascinating document.
Yeah.
That really should be more better known. In terms of your class on Christology, we celebrated last year the 1700th anniversary of the Nicene Creed. Hopefully we all know that we believe that Jesus Christ is true God and true man.
Yeah.
God from God, light from light. But maybe just what is it about that class that you loved and that you enjoyed teaching?
Yeah, well, I'm still in the process of teaching that one, and it's been an absolute blast. So these are the men who are in training to be permanent deacons.
Right.
And the book I'm having them read is, it goes into the history that from Nicaea to Constantinople, you know, so from 325 to 381. And we tend to paint this very neat picture, like once Nicaea happened, everything was fine. It was the opposite of that. Nicaea actually created a really bad, set of theological storms. And what they are really finding interesting is the reasons why people like Athanasius and Gregory of Nyssa and Augustine fought so hard in defense of Nicaea. And it's not first theoretical stuff. It's very much practical stuff. Like, if Jesus is not God, how does he put us in contact with God? Like, if he doesn't have eternal life, how can he give us eternal life? These are very practical questions, you know, and not esoteric. Or they would argue, the baptismal formula says we're baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Are two of the person's names we're baptized in not divine? What does that say about our baptism? So there's, again, very practical questions. Or why are we worshiping Jesus in church if he's not God? That sounds something we shouldn't be doing, right? So to get these guys to see that these were not first and foremost philosophical questions, although they could get very, very heady, they were first and foremost ways of defending just things that Christians were doing and practicing that needed to be defended. Yeah.
It's all a matter of salvation.
If
Jesus is not God,
yeah,
then his death on the cross for us doesn't save us.
Yes.
But if he's not truly human, then his death on the cross doesn't save us.
Yeah, that's very good.
And if the Holy, this came a little bit later, but in that journey of those couple hundred years that you're describing,
yeah,
if the Holy Spirit is not God, then he does not join us perfectly with God as we receive that gift of the Holy Spirit. And yeah, it's all about salvation.
Yes.
And maybe just a little, kind of getting away from the classwork, use as you've been a year here at the seminary, I think it's always good for our listeners to have a sense of what happens here. Tell us a little bit about the experience of a layman coming to work and teach and spend a lot of time around a seminary community. What's that been like for you?
It's been very, very interesting because I've never, you know, I'm not a cradle Catholic, and many of my friends who teach Catholic theology were at one time in the seminary and then they decided not to become priests. But so most of my friends just take for granted that everybody knows what a seminary is like and kind of how it works. And I came in here almost totally clueless. So it's been really fun for me to see sort of how a seminary works and the camaraderie. It feels very much like a family, much more than a university does. And that's both can be a good thing, and it also can be a challenging thing because everybody knows everybody's business and all that. So it has the benefits of the family feel, but it also seems to me to have some of the challenges of the family feel. And that's great. I mean, it's kind of as it should be. But these guys in the classroom, and this is true even of the guys preparing for the diaconate who don't live on campus, there's a real brotherhood between the young men in the various configurations, et cetera, because they're moving through together all the time and they're in classes together and they really get to know each other well. And I always try to convince them, like when they're preparing for exams or writing papers, to cooperate, like help each other. Don't make it a competition. When I said, until the time you sit down to take this exam, I want you guys cooperating with each other. Those of you who are smarter, help those of them who are struggling. Those of you who know more about this, help those that know more about that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And getting them to understand that this is teamwork. This is really a, treat it like a family. Like you would want your brother to do well in this exam, then help your fellow seminarian to do well in the exam if you can, or whatever, or papers, or all that. So I've really enjoyed the experience of community here. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that there's an enormous amount of enthusiasm about the faith at this seminary. Nobody seems to be like, oh, I have to be a Catholic. Everybody seems to be like, isn't it great that we get to be Catholic? And that's contagious. And that's really helped me grow in my faith. That's been a wonderful experience for me. And then in turn, I can show that, I can put that before the seminarians and make them more enthused about theirs. So that's been a really nice experience for me.
That is beautiful. And certainly that sense of wanting to build each other up, wanting to edify each other, is really important. I would be concerned if anybody were here and saying, oh, gee, I've got to be a Catholic. I would be concerned. I think our listeners would be as well. But that's very important. I can get why, for you, that would be an important thing to see things a little bit differently.
Yeah.
As you kind of think of this year, maybe is there one experience that stands out as, this might be a tough question, because obviously I'm your boss who's doing this interview, but is like maybe one experience that stands out as, this is a confirmation that this is where the Lord wants me now.
Wow. You know, that's great. I mean, for what, I mean, to go back just a little bit, I was getting a little bit burnt out teaching undergrads, to be honest with you. It's because it's just constantly, it's like pulling teeth, because you're constantly trying to convince them that they need to be there. And that can be good, but it can also be exhausting. And I'm 60 years old now, so I think I was just getting exhausted. And at the same time, my wife was, she was like, why do we spend our whole lives in Pennsylvania when my family's in Southern Florida? So it was just interesting. I just out of the blue, I emailed Father Cusick, and I had written a letter of recommendation.
Who's your academic dean and vice rector?
Yeah, the dean. And I had written a letter of recommendation for another faculty member who got hired here a few years ago, because I have known him for a long, long time. And I thought, I am just going to out of the blue email Father Cusick and just say, hey, if there's ever something at the seminary that you think I could do, let me know. And I just thought that was the most ridiculous thing in the world, because I had been chair of the department at DeSales, and I would get these out of the blue emails and I would forget about them because you just don't, that's not how you get a job in academia. You don't just email somebody. But from the moment I sent that email, I kind of felt like it wasn't simply a waste of my time. It wasn't just an absurd thing. And the way everything unfolded after I sent that email, it could not have been any more sort of beautiful. It's like stars were aligning. And I felt so much peace right out of the gate. And I felt that to this minute, like being here at the seminary. It's not that everything's perfect. I mean, it's not that at all. It can be stressful, and it can be, et cetera, et cetera. It's just that I have felt absolute peace about what I'm doing. And I feel confirmed from my colleagues, and I feel confirmed from the seminarians. And that's been a wonderful feeling for me. Yeah.
Well, that is terrific. And certainly it's wonderful. It is wonderful to have you here. I can say that what I hear from your students is that they're really enjoying having you here as well.
That's great.
And maybe just one last question. If you have any word to say, and obviously you're in a different position, but if you had any word to say to our listeners about listening to God's call in their lives and helping others to listen to God's call in their lives, from your perspective as a theologian, anything you might say?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I mean, we just talked about in my ecclesiology course, the universal call of holiness. And I think there's a danger sometimes in the Catholic Church that lay people feel like that's the religious and priest's job to be holy, and my job is just to receive sacraments and kind of all that. So I would just encourage you lay people out there who are listening to take ownership of your faith and make sure that you're actively participating in it and not just receiving.
Rodney, Dr. Rodney Houser. It's great to have you with us. For those who might want to look him up and see things that he's written, it's Houssare. But Rodney, it's wonderful to have you with us. To our listeners, we'll see you next month as we continue through this season of Lent. Next month, by the time we're together, it'll be this great, wonderful, joyful time of Easter. God bless you all, and see you next month on Divine Mercy Radio, Vocation Station. Till next month.